You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
Welcome on back to Dana and Parks. We are super excited for this hour, and we don't do this very often. I love books. I love reading. I love authors. But if we're honest, we hear about authors with new material, what would you say, Dan? Probably 100 times a week.
Often.
It is not often I will reach out to somebody and say, are they going to be in town? I would really like to interview them about this book. And I only say that because if you're a writer, I love you. I love your work. But there's this thing that, like, if we have an author on, 400 people will reach out to us tomorrow and say, can you have me on? It's not that we don't want to. It's just that we would be doing a lot of that. And there's other stuff to talk about going on in the world. Long story short, my favorite little newspaper, Martin City Telegraph, writes this week. And I reached out and said, we have to have Tom on the show. It says, General Order Number 11 was an evil. The scorched land it left behind, a hell on earth. On August 25th, 1863, 25,000 Missouri residents in Jackson, Cass, Bates, and part of Vernon counties were ordered to leave their homes. Properties were plundered. Crops were seized, and homes, barns, and structures were burned to the ground. And in fact, I did not know this, the area was given the name the Burnt District. The only structures left standing were stone chimneys. General Order Number 11, issued by Brigadier General Thomas Ewing Jr., was the Union's response to William Quantrill's raid on Lawrence, which left 120 people dead and most of the town, as you know, in ashes. The government order gave Confederate sympathizers 15 days to evacuate. Quoting here, most of the men were off fighting or had already died. So a lot of the evacuees were the wives and the mothers, leading their children and sometimes elderly people to find someplace else to live. It was a measure that our government took against its citizens, who for the most part had not committed any crimes, had not broken any law. It seemed like a very compelling story worth telling. And that is a quote from author Tom Owens, who joins us live in studio today. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dana, and I surely do appreciate the invitation.
One of the first things I asked you, have you lived in Kansas? Do you live in Missouri? From what experience did you bring this story to the pages?
Well, I've lived on both sides of the state line here in the Kansas City area, but my inspiration mostly stemmed from what I learned as a tour guide at the John Warnell House at 61st and Warnell Road in Kansas City. Which has very strong connections to the border conflict and the Civil War that followed. The other connection that I have, which really inspired me, was my family has owned property in Bates County for a number of years, and I basically grew up with 1 foot down there, 1 foot in Kansas City, fishing for bluegill, and so forth. But I would look out across that land and I tried to imagine what happened here during the border conflict years leading up to the Civil War. This wasn't just a creek running through here. There were people living here. And there were people caught in the crossfire of the border conflict. Hardly anyone was left, well, after General Order Number 11, no one was left untouched by it.
So families who were living in Bates, Cass, Jackson, parts of Vernon counties,
yes,
were basically told, get out.
It was forced evacuation. Some 25,000 people were forcibly removed by the Union cavalry from their homes. This amounted to about 2,800 farms. They burned the houses, the crops, the fences. They killed the livestock, except for the chickens and the ducks that they could carry on their horses. and became known as the Burnt District. It was completely laid waste. The only thing left standing, as you mentioned, were the chimneys, often made of flat limestone. And I use, of course, the chimney is the name of my novel, and I use that as a symbol of endurance and resilience on the part of the people who were most affected by this conflict.
The Chimney is the name of the book. It is your first. You have been a docent at the John Warnell House for 4 years. It was essentially a field hospital, yes?
Well, yes, it became a field hospital on the third day of the Battle of Westport. The Confederates controlled the land around what is now Luce Park, and south toward the John Warnell House, and they started using the John Warnell House as a field hospital. They commandeered the house. They tore out the handrail going up to the second floor. Every inch of the house, downstairs and upstairs, was covered with wounded and dying men. As the tide of the battle turned that day, this is October 23rd, 1864, the Confederate Army fled south, and the Union Army took over. So the Union Army used the John Warnell House as a field hospital in the afternoon. John Warnell's wife had to cook for both armies that day.
No.
Yes. Yeah. John Warnell himself was trapped behind Union lines in Westport, and he watched the battle unfold from the top of the Harris House. It was his wife and his young son, 9-year-old Frank.
Wow.
That were there at the house.
You happened to attend the great University of Kansas. City of Lawrence, one of my favorite towns in the world, if not my favorite town in the world. How did that shape? You know, we grew up just sort of knowing Kansas, good. Missouri, you know. Free State Brewery exists in Lawrence for a reason. How did that color your research going in, and then what did you learn, not only through your work with the museum, but just in the extensive research of what happened to all of those Missouri families in researching this book?
Yeah. The first thing I found out is that this history is a lot more complex than is generally known.
Yeah.
Quantrill's raid on Lawrence, of course, was off. They burned half the town. They murdered
the men and
150
boys.
Men and boys, and it was, you know, a very atrocious act. But it did not happen in isolation. And to understand a little bit of the backdrop, if I may delve into it a little bit, you need to understand that slavery was the central source of conflict in American politics, almost since the founding of the Republic. And when Missouri became a state or applied for statehood, there were 24 states. They were equally divided between free states and slave states, where slavery was legal. So there were 12 and 12. And so they came up in Washington, they came up with what was called the Missouri Compromise. And they said, Maine, okay, Maine will be free. Missouri will allow slavery in Missouri. But they were basically kicking the can down the road. So that legislative bailing wire held for 34 years. And along comes Kansas and Nebraska in 1854. The Kansas-Nebraska Act said, slavery, the issue of slavery, the central issue surrounding politics, would not be determined in Washington. Rather, it would be the settlers in the territory of Kansas who would determine the status of slavery. So, what happens? The Missourians are already there, and they're looking across the border at Kansas and say, well, this is ours. This is our birthright. This is right next door. And some very fierce abolitionists from the Northeast, from Massachusetts and other places, principally a man named Amos Lawrence, financed immigrant societies of very ardent abolitionists to travel down and populate Kansas. So you'd have people voting for Kansas as a free state, and then the Missourians weren't going to sit by and watch these people coming off the steamboat down at the River Market. These people from Boston said, what are they doing here? This is ours. So the tensions really found focus in Kansas. And so you've got 6 years before the national war started. You have 6 years of ideological and violent physical conflict. You've got ballot stuffing. You've got pillaging. As many as 200 murders were committed for political reasons during these years. So this was a grim dress rehearsal for the national war that was to follow in 1861. So Lawrence was a stronghold of abolition activity, and the Jayhawkers, or also known as the Redlegs, they were raiding into Missouri and burning towns and farms and plundering. And,
see, I don't remember learning that in history.
And well, the victor writes the history.
That's right. To the victor go the spoils. Will you sit tight and stick with us for one more segment? Our guest this hour is Tom Owens, author of The Chimney. And get your hands on this book. We're going to tell you how when we get back for a real in-depth look at what was going on right here in our neighborhoods during this time. We'll be back with much more with our guest straight ahead on Dana and Parks. Welcome on back to Dana and Parks. You can find the book on Amazon. It is called The Chimney by our guest this hour, Tom Owens. And it's called The Chimney because that's about all that was left standing in several of our counties during this border war. And people throw around that term, Tom, until you really started researching this. Did you even have a firm understanding or grasp of how dark this time was in our history?
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, it basically, the extent of my understanding was Quantrill's raid on Lawrence.
That's it.
And then the MU-KU football and basketball games.
Correct.
It seemed rather trivial to me until I got down and started understanding the history before Lawrence was attacked. The Jayhawkers attacked Osceola, Missouri, and burned that, and burned five other towns in Missouri.
There was bloodshed all around.
There was atrocities committed in both directions, and the Brigadier General Thomas Ewing, who issued Order Number 11, which, by the way, was approved by President Lincoln. He became so frustrated with the Missouri guerrilla fighters raiding into Kansas that he gathered up the women and girls that were suspected of collaborating with the Missouri guerrilla fighters, known as bushwhackers, and there was a group of about 20 that were crowded into a makeshift jail in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. And the circumstances are rather mysterious, but the jail collapsed. And several of these women died, were injured or maimed. And now, Quantrill had already planned his raid on Lawrence by that time. This is just a few days away. But what happened to those women and girls certainly was a big impetus for them carrying out the raid on Lawrence with the ferocity that they did.
So 25,000 Missouri residents in Jackson, Cass, Bates, and part of Vernon counties were ordered to leave their homes. Most of them women, a lot of them women, children, elderly. Your book explores what that must have been like for some of these women who had small children. And what, like, do you know what became of the 25,000 people that, like, one day were living in Jackson and Cass, mm-hmm. and the next, like, then the government said, get out?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no clear historical record about what happened to so many people that got forcibly displaced. Some of them were able to reach relatives in other parts of Missouri or other parts of the country, or friends, and some of them probably suffered, and who knows what fate may have befallen them. But very sad thing is that after the war, they came back to their property, of course, which was cinders on the ground.
Yeah, nothing left.
Except the chimneys. The union government, now in control of Missouri, said, welcome back. You owe 3 years of back taxes. Well, these people, they had no way to get a crop in the ground. They couldn't get loans. They had no assets. So many of the properties were taken this time, not by the sword and the gun, but by the pen and the law. And so they were forcibly removed a second time.
Wow. Is there a plaque somewhere in Jackson or Cass, Bates? You know, the people that are listening, they're like, where do they go to see this? Bricks left?
Yeah, in Harrisonville, Missouri, there is an actual chimney that survived the actions of General Order Number 11 and the burning of the district. I think it's just outside Harrisonville, yeah, there aren't very many relics left.
No.
So this is the kind of history you have to go digging for, by and large.
Well, I want to come see you at the museum. I'm going to do that. We just had some folks on to talk about the fundraiser to help get that back up to where it should be. And we all need to be exploring the history that is around us. That has to be something that you've taken from this, that all of this incredible history is literally sometimes in bricks around us.
Yeah, you know, and I think, Dana, that history is learned and appreciated best when it's told through stories. It makes the history come alive rather than trying to slog through a very dense textbook full of dates and names. And through this novel, I hope to bring to life the experience of the common people and how the war the conflict affected them. I think it's a really compelling story, so much so that I wrote a book about it. And I think it's a story that other people can
because even
too.
Within these families, there had to have been women that were displaced that were vehemently against slavery, who just happened to be in Missouri because their family settled in Missouri.
Yeah.
Just because you lived on one side of state line didn't mean you agreed.
No, Missouri was a state where slavery was legal, but it was populated by sympathizers on both sides, pro-slavery and anti-slavery, or neutral. Most people simply wanted to live their lives out. Only about 16% of Missouri families held slaves. So the rest of them, now many of them sympathized with the institution of slavery, but they were not slaveholders. You had a real mix of people here, and most of them were targeted unjustly.
I love everything about this. The book is The Chimney. You can find it on Amazon. You can search The Chimney or search our local author, Tom Owens. Thank you so much for joining us. You say you're writing a sequel. I want to have you back when that's done.
Okay. Thank you.
Be
it's
well,
my pleasure.
Friend. And thank you for your time today. We're back after this.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, thanks to Tom Owens, because that was incredible.
Incredibly fascinating.
I just wish that's how history was presented to us growing up, Sam. I've always said this, and I told Tom this during a break. I learned more in my adult years about history reading historical fiction more 10,000 times over than I ever learned in any high school history class, ever. And part of that, we had good teachers. I'm not saying we didn't, but you have to have someone who tells the story, who engages the students and explains it in a way that makes it exciting and interesting and relevant. And that is not vomiting a bunch of dates at people about wars that your grandparents' grandparents don't even remember, right?
Well, and he also keyed on it, is that history is written by the victor. We lose all of the nuance in these conflicts because we say, as you kind of summarized, this side good, that side bad,
right?
And that's all we learn.
A little more complicated than that. So huge thanks. Again, the book is The Chimney by local author Tom Owens. And there's a great article that we will post with his photograph here on my social media channels here in a bit.
That sounds like
out
a book.
Of the Martin City Telegraph.
I might actually read cover to cover.
He brought me a copy. I'm so excited.
Nice.
And now we're going to Hell in a Handbasket from CBS News.
Oh, here we go.
AI companies are creating generative ghosts of deceased loved ones.
Yep.
Here we go.
Yep.
Jack Manning knows firsthand the emotional and practical challenge of memorializing a loved one in a way that feels appropriate. He lost his sister more than 10 years ago.
Appropriate.
He and his family spent hundreds of hours raising funds to organize a volunteer project honoring her. It took years, he says, of bake sales and 5K to raise money to honor her memory in a way that was meaningful to us. He told CBS News, I thought, surely there could be a way that technology can help us. Enter artificial intelligence. Manning, a doctoral candidate in information science at the University of Colorado Boulder, is now studying the use of large language models, LLMs, to create what some are calling generative ghosts. Basically, AI chatbots trained on a dead person's social media posts, emails, audio and video recordings, photos, and other data to create a digital simulation that family and friends can, quote, interact with after an individual's death.
Right.
Quoting here from Manning, it's definitely a growing sector. We are seeing growth in interest in how AI and grief intertwine.
Well, obviously there's growth in interest because 2 years ago we didn't even think this was possible.
A number of startups now offer these services. Seance AI.
Yeah. Hey, at least they're honest.
No. You Only Virtual and RE Memory.
Seance AI.
RE Memory lets users create lifelike avatars of their loved ones based on photos and voice recordings.
Yep. This is the way of the future.
An associate professor at the University of Colorado Boulder who studies socio-technical systems, Manning and his colleagues observed study participants' reactions to the AI ghosts of people they had lost. Quote, participants filled out a simple survey, sharing positive memories of a loved one, talking about their upbringing, their core traits.
Mm-hmm.
And they were fascinated by how much this system can do with so little information. There are two basic kinds of generative ghosts. A simple, quote, death bot could be limited to playing back verbatim any statements recorded by a loved one, but would be incapable of simulating the deceased's manner of communication.
So basically, you're just feeding a bunch of quotes into something that is mimicking its voice. It's not actually recreating the thoughts that your loved one would have had.
It would be replaying Dana on Dana and Parks to my children someday. Like what I actually said. Generative ghosts, you guys, go significantly further by recreating the deceased's voice and manner of communication and offering the ability to interact with the living, even responding to questions in a recognizably familiar way.
Literally inputting their personality into a digital cloud.
No. Oh, and by the way, it's only $24 a month. This is not healthy for anyone. Call me right now and change my mind. There's no way this is normal. There's no way this is healthy. This is not the same as playing an outgoing answering machine message from your father who you lost 10 years ago.
I was about to use that exact example.
Or listening to a voicemail, the last voicemail you have from your grandmother. You can hear the voice and you smile.
And it brings you warmth. It brings you warmth. Good memories about times with them.
You might shed a tear and you think, oh my God, I miss her voice. I miss her voice so much.
Recreating them is almost like getting your dog taxidermied in a seated position and setting them next to the front door.
And worse, then saying, hey, grandma, would you like to go to the store? And then this generative chatbot replies, yeah, I would like to go to the store. Remember how you used to love my lasagna? No!
From the text line, boo! Pun intended.
I mean, you guys.
Now.
This is no.
Well, let's go down the further implications of this. Because if we're now exploring the technology and the ability to quite literally upload someone's entire personality into a cloud-based server so that then they can be interacted with for eternity, by the way, this isn't going to go away. So when you put Grandpa Bob into the, what was it, something AI?
Seance AI.
Into Seance AI, Bob is now going to be accessed or able to be accessed 100 years from now.
Yeah.
So,
but
right
it's not
now,
you're saying it's Bob. This is not Bob.
But right now, we're talking about it from, okay, well, maybe I can talk to a loved one. In 100 years, we'll be like, well, I wonder what Ronald Reagan would think about this. And then we're going to go to the Ronald Reagan AI and be like, hello, Mr. Former President. What should we do?
All right. What do you think? 913-586-7798. We'll take your calls here. The researchers found, this is terrifying, that study participants generally preferred communicating with an AI ghost of their loved one, quote, in the first person, with the chatbot serving as a direct reincarnation rather than an avatar speaking in the third person. They preferred the ghost actually saying, hi, Dana, I miss you. They preferred that instead of the third person. One turnoff. If a bot used a term of endearment that their loved one typically did not say, like, hey, champ, how you doing today, pal?
Buddy.
And your loved one did not use words like that, a user wanted to end the interaction. That was the turnoff. Well, of course there's going to be terms used that your loved one didn't use. This is not your loved one.
Interesting from the text line. What if it's a situation, and I'm going to use Scott and his dad as an example, where his daughters never really got to know Mayo. If there was enough audio data, enough personality data, that there was a situation where they could recreate Mayo, I'm just using that as an example. Apply that to any situation in your own life. Would that be a little bit different? Like, I knew my grandfather. I know a lot of great stories about my grandfather, but he died when I was 4. Is that a more comfortable application of this? Because it's less so we're running away from the grief.
I think you're running away from the grief, number one. And most people, number two, are not going to have an audio vault as significant as someone who's spent their entire career in broadcasting.
That's true, yeah.
Right? So you're going to end up with things that your loved one didn't say, like, hey, bud.
And inflections that aren't there.
And inflections that aren't there.
You're going to get used to those inflections, and you're going to think that that's actually them, and you're going to misremember them.
That nightmares are made of.
Sounds like a Black Mirror episode.
It does sound like a Black Mirror episode. We have one line open. Phones have just exploded. Please call in. Ooh, very touchy stuff. We will take your call straight ahead on Dana and Parks. All of the really creepy horror movies that you can think of, like, oh, here's one, Pet Sematary, where people start bringing things back to life, like that cat church that I still can't get out of my head, and it's been like 35 years since that awful movie came out.
Have we not learned our lesson?
You should just let some things be.
Yeah.
Keep the voice recording from the answering machine or from your voicemail. I just don't think we need to be propping up grandma as some kind of chat bot that you can have a conversation with. No.
Or better yet, grieve.
Yeah.
Just grieve. It sucks. We all go through horrible things.
It is the worst.
It never gets better. It just gets easier. Just grieve.
I think this is the opposite of grieving.
I think it's a step backward,
actually. You're going the wrong way if you're still having these conversations.
By the way, there have been studies done into this as they've implemented this new technology where it can actually launch you back into that grief. So if you've already grieved and somebody comes to you and says, man, wouldn't you love to have one more conversation with your dad? It can launch you right back into it.
But it's not having a conversation with your dad. Let's go to George in Kansas City. Hi, George.
How y'all doing today?
So good. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I was just talking with Sam when I called in, and I'm saying the technology, it could be used for good, it could be used for bad, just like good and evil. The technology, which I saw in a Superman movie back in, the 78 or 79, was with the Christopher Reeves and his father when he was a little baby sending him from Krypton to Earth. He put all his knowledge that he could possibly ask him and answer him on his crystal.
Oh, that's
so
right.
When he grew up, he can just ask a question. Now, for me, I want my dad to come back so I can talk to him. But if I had a grandson or a son that wanted to talk to his great grandfather, his father, he should be able to do that, to get advice.
Or as close as you think it could be to what maybe you would have said, George. I mean, that's where you're rolling the dice. You know, I think about like one of my favorite human beings in the whole wide world, my dad. I would not be able with a straight face to have some AI ghost conversation with him because he's the first person that would say, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. I'm gone. Let me go. Looney Tune, stop having a conversation with your dead, dear old dad. Go to therapy. He literally would say that. And so in talking with this fake ghost of him, I would just crack up knowing how ridiculous he would think this whole thing was.
Well, and we know about all of the errors with large language models, and this is just a different application of these large language models,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
They're wrong 10 to 60% of the time. And you had mentioned the different nuances, the different things that they might say that would kind of trip you up to let you know that it's not actually them.
Yeah.
So maybe, grandpa wasn't the guy that used all those old people catchphrases, but I just Googled some old people catchphrases.
Yeah.
So, you're talking to fake AI grandpa and he just randomly hits you with well, heavens to Betsy.
You've never said that.
You got a
burr
in
your saddle today, Sam.
Newsflash, buddy. Oh, man, you're trying to put 100 pounds of stuff into a 90-pound bag.
Do you know what scares me, Sam? The AI ghost, if you thumbs down that, would, in time,
get used to
start massaging it to be as close as it can come to what you think your grandfather would have said. You know what my grandpa used to say when he would give us advice? He'd be talking about something.
Okay.
It could be anything, something in the news or whatever. And he would always end it with, now, I'm not preaching to you. I'm just saying that this is something to consider. He would always say that. Now, I'm not preaching to you.
Yeah.
And so if that happened through some AI chatbot and it was his voice saying that, I would go white as an actual ghost and pass out. Because
is this the seance?
But if it was something like you just said.
He's one sandwich short of a picnic.
No, he would not say. You know what your loved ones sound like.
Hey, why don't you use your head for something other than a hat rack?
Gary,
it makes me uncomfortable.
In Kansas City, you can wrap us up, Gary. Hi, go ahead.
Okay, the afterlife. Once I start talking about the cloud, I've got the feeling that there's angels up there, and probably the afterlife is going into the cloud.
All of it. The afterlife will be
and
in
it's
the
not
cloud.
AI, it's the cloud. It's the afterlife.
I was told to look for clouds. No, no, they're talking about the cloud. That's where grandma lives now.
The
Not
cloud.
Really grandma. It's sort of seance grandma.
The
You're going to love her.
The cloud makes all the decisions.
Lord.
The cloud knows all.
I it's not good. It's not good. We will be back with much more on Dana and Parks, including a very, very bad beaver upstate. Bad beaver. Bad. Authorities are issuing a dire warning. You got to be careful around those little buggers. Stick with us.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.